Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Real World Ophthalmology Podcast, where we explore the latest advancements and insights for young ophthalmologists for enhanced education year-round. I'm Dr. Lisa Nijem, the creator of Real World Ophthalmology, and I'm delighted to be joined by my wonderful co-host, Dr. Allison Early.
Hi, Lisa. I am so happy to be here. I'm Dr. Allison Early. I'm a cataract and refractive surgeon at Cincinnati Eye Institute in Cincinnati, Ohio. We are so excited tonight to welcome our incredible guests, Dr. Vance Thompson and Dr. Mitchell Jackson. Dr. Thompson is a board-certified ophthalmologist and director of refractive surgery at Vance Thompson Vision, and currently serves as a professor of ophthalmology in the Sanford School of Medicine at the University of South Dakota. Dr. Jackson is a board-certified ophthalmologist specializing in cataract and refractive surgery, and is the founder and medical director of Jackson Eye. He's also a clinical assistant professor at the University of Chicago Hospitals. Thank you so much to you both for joining us today.
Thank you for having us. It's an honor to be here with real world ophthalmology and also Mitch, the man. I'm honored.
I'm always humbled to be with Vance because he always makes my head really big.
Well, we're excited to have both of you here, and we appreciate you sharing your knowledge so much with our audience. Today's topic is something that I know actually that all four of us is near and dear to our hearts, and things that we, you know, really are important for patients. So we're going to be talking about refractive options for the early career surgeon. What things to consider? How do you get good at being a refractive surgeon? And what should a young ophthalmologist starting their career do or know about refractive surgery to help them shape their career and come out with the best outcomes for their patients? Today's refractive surgery options range from corneal reshaping with lasers to surgical insertion of lenses. ICL has grown a great deal in the last few years, and all different types of LASIK and different lasers. Where do you want to start, Allison? It's a big topic.
Yeah, I think it is. And I think we each have a unique perspective to offer. We're each in different types of practices. And I think it would help our guests to get to know each of us, and maybe specifically you two, Dr. Thompson and Dr. Jackson, if you could share with us a little bit about how you started out in refractive surgery. Was it something that you did specific training on? My experience, as I mentioned, now I would consider myself a cataract and refractive surgeon. I am a comprehensive ophthalmologist. My experience in training was a lot of people telling me you don't need to do a fellowship to do refractive surgery. And then there are people who feel that you do need to do a fellowship to do it. So I would love to hear from both of you what your path was to getting to where you are now.
I'll let you go first, because I have a good thing to follow up on.
So for me, I did a fellowship in refractive surgery, and I did that in 1990. So it's been a while. And I was fascinated with the idea of helping people with their refractive errors, you know, whether it was, you know, minimizing refractive errors so they didn't need glasses or contact lenses, or optimizing their image quality. And in my fellowship, I'll never forget, my fellowship director was Dan Dury in refractive surgery and John Hunkler in cataract surgery. And like I tell my patients, I work on the cornea in front of your pupil and the lens behind your pupil and implants that go in between the two. And that's pretty much where I spend my career. But in my fellowship, Dan Dury hands me a Sony Handycam on the first day, July 1, 1990, and says, Mickey Gordon is doing this procedure called PRK in San Diego, and I would like you to take this video camera and video this because I'm supposed to be there. And then followed up with my first PRK here in Kansas City. I go out to San Diego, watch one of the greatest refractive surgeons ever in Mickey Gordon do his PRK. I bring back the video footage and watch another great in refractive surgery, Dan Dury, do his first PRK. And that started my journey. We did the legally blind PRK trial that year, the PTK trial. And after my fellowship, I came back to Sioux Falls and got involved in the beginning of the PRK sighted eye trials, the LASIK trials, and the phakic IOLs, and eventually SMILE, and, you know, a lot of advanced lens replacement options. So my career has been one where I've been highly interested in clinical research involving corneal laser, phakic IOL, and lens replacement. But that's kind of how I got started in my journey doing a fellowship.
Wow, that's amazing. I did not know that, Vance. Taking a video camera and going to, he's like pioneer. All right, Mitch, you got to top him now.
I'm trying to follow right behind Vance's footsteps. It's funny because I'm going to go fast forward and go backwards. Vance and I were at Alcon and the pioneers of LASIK picture together with Marguerite and Dan Dury. And I looked like I was 10 years old in the picture.
It's only a few years ago.
I'm humbled to be in it, but I guess I made the cut because I started way back in the 90s like these guys. I ended up getting an opportunity. Well, my first PRK patient, believe it or not, was in 1995 when it was finally approved on a Summit laser. It was on a malpractice attorney. N equals one. That's a true story. I still see him. He doesn't need lens exchange yet, almost. But he said, I'm a defending attorney of you doctors, so I know all the risks and benefits. And so he was willing to take the chance. And he had, still good to this day, and he knows he's going to need a lens exchange soon, but that was my first brave example. And then I started with the Summit Vizx, ended up with the LADAR Vision laser, went to Technolos, just like Vance. We've been through all the iterations of lasers. I had the opportunity, Moria at the time was a big microkeratome company, and they offered me to be one of their key trainers. So I ended up training about 800 surgeons worldwide on that device. And I really learned a lot about LASIK, because when you have to teach it, you really learn it. And so that kind of led to what I do now, is I offer a refractive cataract fellowship. I believe Vance does too, through the SF match through the AO, which has been really nice that I can actually train docs for the future. I didn't have that opportunity. It was a pure cornea option only. So I went out cold turkey. So I kind of like learned LASIK on my own. And just by having to teach people with the Moria, I really learned everything and got exposed to all the lasers. And I believe RSA also offers a fellowship too. So there's a lot of opportunities for young doctors to get involved now and do a kind of a private practice refractive cataract fellowship, which I would have done in a heartbeat if it existed, because I wasn't looking to be a pure cornea surgeon when I started.
So interestingly enough, I did my fellowship with Mark Manis and Ivan Schwab at UC Davis, and it is a cornea refractive fellowship. But at the time, they just had they had the microkeratome, and they got the femtosecond laser at the very end of the year that I was there. So even though I did a cornea refractive fellowship, it wasn't until I got out in practice and had the opportunity to work in Santa Rosa with a few different people who ended up being great mentors and helped me learn femtosecond LASIK in my first year of practice. And then in my second year of practice, I ended up moving to Springfield, Illinois to work with my med school mentor. And they didn't have anyone in the area doing femtosecond LASIK. They were still all using the microkeratome. So I became the first surgeon in Central Illinois to perform femtosecond LASIK. And at the time, AMO couldn't believe that there was anywhere in the country that didn't have femtosecond LASIK. So they flew in corporate people. They took pictures. It was this whole big deal because I brought this new technology to an underserved area. So it's interesting that you say all this, because I think fellowship was great for me and really important in a lot of different ways. And yet you still have to continue that learning when you finish, regardless of whether you do a fellowship or not.
That's great. I think it's really interesting hearing everyone's story. And I think we can all agree that it's really critical to have a good framework for selecting patients for whichever refractive procedure you might recommend to them. So can you walk us through some of the high points on when somebody comes in for a consult with you? What are some of the major things that you're considering when evaluating a patient for refractive surgery?
Let's start this time. This is what I teach all my fellows. I go, and a lot of patients get upset when they have the money and want to do, like, for example, LASIK or PRK or an ICL, whatever it is. And I always tell them, I can do perfect surgery on you, but you will not get a perfect outcome unless you're a perfect candidate. And that's what I tell every single patient, my fellows, because there's a lot that goes into determining a perfect candidate, whether it's, you know, you look at their lifestyle questionnaire and see if they're psychologically capable of handling a procedure, all the way to having a, you know, normal corneal topography or tomography or epithelial mapping. And, you know, you have to look at the, you know, the macula and look at higher order aberrations. There's, as you all know, there's so much that goes into selecting the perfect candidate based on their prior refractive error and pre-existing comorbidities. If they already have a really bad dry eye, for example, you have to explain that's going to be exacerbated most likely post-operatively. And our goal is to really set expectations. A lot of it's just setting expectations, you know, the usual, you know, over-deliver, you know, and just kind of set expectations, but you have to do the proper preoperative diagnostic testing.
I agree. And, you know, Mitch just went through everything just so beautifully. And one of the things that I like to do is kind of approach the beginning kind of simple as I'm trying to get to know that patient. And, you know, I'm looking, of course, at their manifest refraction and the level of their myopia, hyperopia, astigmatism, starting to think about if they are a good candidate, is it going to be a corneal refractive? Is it going to be a phakic IOL? Is it lens replacement? Or are they best served with nothing? And so one of my first crossroads is, how is your low light image quality? I like to call it my poor man's wavefront, that if they find when they're driving at night in a construction zone and it's raining and other cars are coming, that they're happy with their image quality, that if my tests line up, they probably have a rather pure optical system, and I'm going to be making a different decision than someone who has a reduced image quality. So that's one of the first things I like to know. And then I like to know, you know, just how satisfied have they been with in contact lens, that if it's someone who with their glasses or contact lenses just seem like they're kind of hard to satisfy, and I want to know where they're from, what they do, and I'm trying to get a feel for the perfectionistic side of them and what their personality is like. But after I know them and their image quality and how glasses or contact lenses work, I, on every single patient, want to know if they rub their eyes. And if there's anything that I wish I'd have maybe understood better at the beginning of my career that I understand so well now, kind of through the school of hard knocks, is this eye rubbing issue, how patients can truly change their own refractive error and literally ruin their corneas and ruin their eyes and dislodge their implants and increase their chance of retinal vitreal issues. And when they have something that looks suspicious and they're not an eye rubber, just like today, I asked you know, a sixth actor myope who was here for LASIK, because there was just something on her topography that didn't look right, and she wasn't an eye rubber. Turns out, when I asked her if she sleeps on her tummy and pushes her face into a pillow, sure enough, she does. It changed our whole course. I really want to know if they put pressure on their eyes.
Wow, that's so insightful. I also think I might sleep on my stomach. If you do find somebody that has pressure on their eyes like that, what do you do? How do you veer, or what kinds of things do you start considering?
Funny, after I said don't rub your eyes, I feel like I have something.
Always happens.
So what I told her was, I said, while you're doing your behavior modification, I would highly suggest you get a pair of good quality goggles. Now, we have goggles. You can also use swimmer's goggles that are very low profile, or, you know, maybe it's your racquetball goggles, but somehow, while you're trying to fix your behavior, you need to protect your eyes because you're hurting them. And so that's the first thing I do is, you know, help them to protect their eyes while they're doing behavior modification. And I always find that, you know, it's good to follow up on these patients. And that is, you know, when we're even going to do what we call a see and do, where someone's traveling for a ways and they're going to do their consultation that morning and their treatment maybe later that afternoon. We will even on their telephone or Zoom telemedicine consultation ahead of time, ask them if they rub their eyes. And a lot of people say no. But the second time, and you guys have all heard this, so, you know, the second time, a lot of them are like, wow, you know, I'm so glad you asked me that because I didn't think I did. But that's how habits are.
Yeah.
And so I just think it's so important that we follow up on these things. And as early as possible in the journey, okay, do you rub your eyes? No. Okay, hi, I'm Dr. Vance Thompson. I mean, I literally want to get that out there.
I love that, Pearl.
Me too. I think that's really high yield. And I think the questioning about low light conditions, that's really insightful as well, just as kind of a zoomed out assessment of somebody's current status.
Can I add one more thing to that? You can do the same thing with your Snellen chart. It's your kind of real-time patient-reported outcome. It may say 20/20, but ask them, how crisp is that 20/20? And if they say, yeah, I can read it, but it's fuzzy, that's a whole different situation.
You're talking about pre-op and post-op, or you're mainly talking about the evaluation?
Pre and post. That's why I think the Snellen chart is awesome, but it doesn't go all the way there. You want to know what line they're reading, but you also want to know what their image quality is like. 20/20 crisp would be great. 20/20 dull, not great.
One device we use, not everybody has, but it quantitates quality, like Vance is saying, is the objective scatter index from the HD analyzer. I love that device because it actually quantitates quality. And if they're in the green, then I know their quality and the low light's really good, and I'm going to feel much better about doing a peer refractive procedure on them. So it's if you have that device, you should be using it preoperatively.
Vance, you mentioned that you with telemedicine visits, and I'm sure that that has allowed a greater number of potential refractive patients to perhaps have access. How do you use telemedicine in your practice right now? And Mitch, if you would comment also, has that been a part of your refractive surgery that you do now that maybe you didn't do before?
Well, you know, as we all know, during COVID, we used it a lot more. And I imagined that we had entered a new era, that we weren't going to go backwards after that. And we went backwards after that. And so, you know, I think it's still, to tell you the truth, a quite underutilized area. But there's just certain things that we have a hard time doing that I don't think is too far away for us to get some, you know, quite sophisticated testing through telemedicine. But I currently, you know, call it you know, teletalking. You know, it's really just a way to communicate, whether you're doing it, you know, over the telephone or through the Zoom. But oftentimes we're utilizing their, you know, doctor's examination data from back home. We're getting to know them. We're able to have our counselors do some of their things that they do. But it's just a great way to start the journey, to see what their personality is like and see what their image quality is like, and not wait for everything, you know, for that day. If someone's just coming in for a consultation, we don't do that, because we're going to get that touch before we make that decision. But if it's someone who's traveling a ways and we're doing a see and do, that's when we really like to take advantage of telemedicine. And I do dream of taking it up a notch, kind of like what we learned during COVID, but kind of waiting for that more sophisticated analysis that can happen virtually to complement that telemedicine visit.
For me, I'm sure for Lisa too, compared to the Dakotas where you're at, it's so populated where I'm at. So we don't really utilize it as much as we did during COVID, but I utilize a lot of my ODs in the area to start the process. And that kind of helps determine if they're, you know, a candidate or not. So that's kind of, I'm lucky that way, because we have a lot of optometrists in the area that can start the process. And then if I do a see and do, they come in, we do our testing and do the procedure, and they go right back to their optometrist. So it works out easier that way. So we probably underutilize it now. We'd use it a lot more during COVID too.
So did you work with your local optometrists and teaching them or training them or working together when you first started? And how would you suggest for young ophthalmologists who want to build that relationship and make sure that we're working together as a team with the optometrists in the area?
Well, one thing, we try and do some CE programs for them. So with talks that are related to that, and they'll usually attend that. But if it's CE, they'll show up. The other thing is, we'll invite them into the practice and observe one-on-one. So they really get to see like pre-op, intra-op, and post-op evaluations. So you can kind of, they see how we handle it from all three levels. So those are the biggest ways we've been doing it.
So I agree with Mitch. You have referring doctors who take kind of an extra interest in refractive surgery, that want to do a mini fellowship and come learn about it. But even if they haven't, just their general exam, you know, just having their manifest and what their vision was corrected to and their exam, and it is important to me. And especially sometimes where I want a cycloplegic refraction, if they're coming and trying to do everything in one day, I really want that ahead of time also. But I'm going to repeat everything, no matter who sends me what data. I'm repeating everything that is really critically important to me. And so their data is just complementing things, and a nice way to start that initial telephone or Zoom conversation that we want to have ahead of time. And remember, we only do that for the people that are trying to get everything done in one day.
Sure.
Well, I think you both touched on that you have had really great career arc with experience throughout kind of the birth of refractive surgeries, especially the laser refractive surgeries. And now we have some lens-based and phakic IOL options. Are there any exciting things you see coming in the future for refractive surgery?
That says what I'm going to talk about, because I've only spent 18 years working on it, is the laser scleral microporation treatment for presbyopia. We just finished our OUS studies and about to launch all our commercial US stuff. And hopefully within a year, a little longer than a year, we might have a device that looks like an excimer laser that treats the sclera. And actually, if you're an emmetropic presbyope and you don't have a cataract yet, we might have something lasting longer than a presbyopia eye drop does, for a patient without any side effect that will allow you to get to a J3 or better level until you get a cataract. So that's my big exciting thing in the future.
That's fabulous and so exciting. I did not know you were the brains behind that, but I heard about it recently. So
he's the global chief medical officer, right?
Global medical director for ACE Vision Group on that.
Yeah.
Wow.
I think we're all excited about the work Mitch is doing. And, you know, there's nothing better than our God-given accommodative mechanism. And if we can, you know, increase its, ability to or kind of wake it up through procedures like this and by another decade or more, what a wonderful addition to refractive surgery. Some of the other things that I'm excited about is really kind of the evolution of our knowledge of what is the sweet spot of these procedures. You know, we used to do a lot higher PRK, LASIK, and SMILE treatments than we do now. The phakic IOLs have become something that we really understand more and more. The EVO ICL and not having to do a PI has really made that an exciting arena. And then the idea of being able to restore reading range in lens replacement procedures with these modern day trifocals and the light adjustable lens, we're doing more refractive lens exchanges and of course, making more cataract surgery patients happy. And I find this kind of comprehensive approach to refractive surgery means you're not pushing these procedures past their limits. You're not pushing the cornea past its limits. You're not trying to squeeze a phakic IOL into too narrow of an aqueous depth. And you're, you know, choosing which procedure is best for which patient. Thinking about the two things that I think about in addition to safety is what is the refractive endpoint we're going for, and what image quality am I going to leave them with? You know, today I did a phakic IOL removal on a patient that I did a phakic IOL on 25 years ago. Yeah. And they had really enjoyed that journey, and it's now time for cataract surgery. And when we analyzed their cornea, their, you know, tear film was happy, their epithelial map was pristine, their topography was pristine. They had the choice of any implant they would want. And this patient ended up choosing a trifocal. Well, if they'd have done a LASIK for that level of correction back then, they wouldn't have had that choice to do a modern day trifocal. The light adjustable lens has been a savior in situations like that. But I think besides trying to figure out how do we optimize which procedure is best for which patient at which age, where are we leaving these patients when they're making these lens replacements decision in 20 years? And that's how we're refining and evolving refractive surgery.
I love the way that you put that, and you've lectured on this for Real World Ophthalmology in the past. And we're so grateful for you sharing your knowledge, Vance, but really understanding corneal-based options for refractive correction and lenticular-based options, and seeing which patients, you said it so eloquently, fitting the patients of procedure as opposed to trying to make the procedure fit for patients where it may not be their best option. And then also having that foresight to think about, you know, what may be later down the line as some of these patients get older and leaving them with their widest range of options. I think those are all really important considerations. We touched on it a little bit earlier, but I'm going to bring you back to it now because this just makes sense to me. Where do you think, how do you think somebody should start? Let's say they may be in practice and now they have the opportunity to start doing some refractive surgery. What kinds of things should they do to make sure that they are learning the laser techniques properly and, you know, getting their knowledge and their skill set up so that they can adequately take care of patients?
I always say the easiest way for somebody to start, at least in refractive cataract, is managing astigmatism. and just learning to do an AI, LRI, or a toric IOL, that's just the first easy way to jump in, because almost everybody you see has some sort of astigmatism that probably needs correction. That's the simplest way, so they understand topography and where to place a lens and where to place incisions and kind of what the effect will, and then you can go from there. I mean, that's the simplest way to start.
And, I think that I feel like for people, like Mitch, who's got so much experience, I think he would agree that the surgery isn't the most difficult part of refractive surgery. You know, a lot of people that are looking to get into it have already mastered cataract surgery and oftentimes even tougher, corneal procedures. Right. And so, the idea of refractive surgery shouldn't intimidate people, but what they should respect and what they're blessed with is modern day diagnostics. That, yes, like Mitch started this program talking about expectations, extremely important, learning how to do a proper patient education on, someone's situation and what their options are. And then I like to think of it just from the front to the back. What's their refractive error? And, what's their tear film analysis? What's their epithelial thickness? What's their corneal topography and tomography? What's their lenticular status? And then, of course, their ocular health. But being able to quantify corneal high-order aberrations and being able to take advantage of all these modern-day diagnostics. I remember refractive surgery in the 90s, you really had to have your thinking cap with regards to the art of refractive surgery. But the companies have brought these amazing diagnostics. And so that's how I would think about it if I was getting into it, is how do I best analyze the eye? What do I need? How do I best educate my patients? And how do I make sure that I'm not just mastering one aspect of refractive surgery, so I push it maybe more than it should be pushed? How do I become a comprehensive refractive surgeon who can reshape corneas, do phakic IOLs, and replace lenses?
Allison, I know that you recently opened up a refractive surgery clinic. You're even a pioneer here. Can you give our listeners some insights from what you've done, being the most recent one from us to venture into this subspecialty?
Sure. I am happy to share a little bit more about my story. I finished residency in 2018. And as I mentioned earlier in the podcast, as a trainee, kind of heard, oh, you can learn LASIK. You don't need to spend a year doing a cornea fellowship, is basically what I was told. And so I joined a practice, and I had the intention from the time that I interviewed that I was interested in refractive surgery. And, for better or worse, I think it is in some ways a tough field to break into, because it is an art. And it's very proprietary in terms of certain techniques and nomograms and things like that. And there's not always somebody who is willing to sit down and take the time to teach you. But what has been really wonderful about kind of putting myself out there and meeting people like you all and Lisa, and, I could name a huge list of names that I've been able to connect with through platforms like this and by attending meetings. And a couple years ago, the opportunity sort of fell into my lap to start offering refractive surgery at my clinic location. And I said, well, that's great, but it feels a little bit like you're going to park a 747 in the parking lot and say, well, you've been on a plane before. Go ahead. You can take off. So it's wonderful to have a laser, but how do I learn how to use it? And so it has definitely been a journey of seeking mentorship on my own, and both people within my practice as well as outside of it, and taking advantage of things like this RSA webinar series, which is designed for, I think, residents and fellows, but it's very valuable. And there's lots of online resources and things like this. But I am that person who was in practice for several years, and you know, not to toot my own horn, but I'm a good surgeon. I do great work, and it was just something that I wanted to pick up and learn how to do. And it's very different than, for example, cataract surgery, where patients are coming in with a pathology, and it's something that there's a very clear path to surgery, and there are insurance options and things like this, versus kind of the young, healthy eye. It feels very different to evaluate and recommend surgery and essentially a lot of times my peers. And so everything that you have said tonight, you know, I'll probably be listening back and taking notes, and I think it'll be a really valuable thing for a lot of young ophthalmologists to listen to. So I thank you.
And I also want to give a plug, because we have the president of Ascaris here with us as well. Vance is the president of Ascaris this year, and we're all very fortunate for that. And I know Vance, Ascaris does have a lot of education on this also, right, to help the young surgeon who may be interested in delving more into refractive surgery.
One of the things that, you know, is so wonderful about what Allison was just talking about, and by the way, congratulations on your success in just having the gumption to do it, you know, because one of the things I think that makes the journey enjoyable at, you know, my age, being the oldest on this program, I still absolutely love what I do. And I want to improve every day. So for you to, you know, kind of just say, I'm going to go learn it more, and I'm going to implement it, and I'm going to take it at my pace. And I know there's wonderful resources out there. Just like Mitch said, you know, we all love it when doctors come to visit, and we're there to talk about those cases. And there's wonderful societies like the ASCRS and the AAO and the RSA and the ACOS meetings and the ESCRS. Doing this continuing education is so helpful, but it also is nice having someone that you can text or email or phone call. And it's one of the things that makes our profession such a joy, is that people are really excited to help each other.
Well, to follow up on one thing, just for a fun fact, the other day, my fellow goes, you're operating on a fourth generation patient, doc. That says a lot. I did their original LASIK when they were really young. Huh. And then I've done cataract, and then their child, LASIK, and then their grandma. I mean, I had a fourth generation refractive cataract finally. As we love what we do, but it's also a practice builder, you know. So for Allison, you know, you started, congrats on starting, but it's going to be a big practice builder, and you're going to get a lot of word of mouth. So for those who aren't doing it, it will generate a lot of new business for the practice.
And in the meantime, Mitch has been aging backwards like Benjamin Button. So his patients get older, but Mitch gets younger. We don't know how it works.
They all say, you never age, doc.
It's the alter ego. We didn't even mention the alter ego today,
MJ. We'll do a special set on DJ MJ in our next podcast.
Well, I will say that all the MJs I've ever known about were larger than life. So.
You guys are
awesome. All right. Maybe this is a good spot to end. So we want to thank Dr. Jackson and Dr. Thompson for being our guests of honor today. We've all learned so much just listening to you and being inspired. And thank you to my co-host, Allison, for sharing the hosting duties and your story too. And congratulations to you on your refractive practice. And we want to really encourage everyone. This is exactly why we do real-world ophthalmology, is to bring seasoned clinicians together with younger surgeons and give you a chance to learn from giants like we have on this podcast. If you're looking for help in refractive surgery or anything else, please reach out to us. We love putting people together. If you're not part of Real World Ophthalmology, it's free. It's by physicians for physicians. And we've got a plethora of educational content at our signature meeting and in-person events. Hit us up on social media and we'll see you soon.